Welcome back to Kyra Nights. I'm Spike O'Neill. Lisa Brooks, by the way, someone wanted to, two things on the text line for you specifically. A Murder of Crows to you, it says, for your take on the Oscars.
Oh, thank you.
They agreed with Spike. Every point you brought up that Frank and I were clueless on, but also that Trading Places, not 48 Hours, is where Jamie Lee Curtis played the lovable hooker.
Thank
I missed it, too.
Yeah.
Thank you, Texter. Trading Places.
Yep.
One of the greatest movies of all time, too. Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd were a great comedy team.
And Donna Meachie I can't remember his name. Great actor. Ralph Bellamy.
Ralph Bellamy, yep.
They were fantastic, too.
The Duke brothers.
Yes.
Oh, the Dukes were great. And what was it, Coming to America, where they made the cameo? Where Eddie Murphy is walking down the waterfront at night and gives the homeless guys a pocket full of cash. Mortimer, we're back. Great callback. Thank you so much, text line. Thank you, Lisa. So we're going to switch gears a little bit here, talk about serious stuff. I apologize. I know it's what the daytime's for. Once the sun goes down, we should be having nothing but fun. Matt did play Dire Straits, Heavy, Heavy Fuel, which we talked about in the pre-show. Thank you. I love that song. Great tune. excuse me. Yep. Lisa says she's worried about me. I'm just worried about my voice. My mind's sharp as a tack. My throat feels like I'm Sam Elliott. I wish I could do Sam Elliott. Well, if I could do Sam Elliott, I'd never have to work again. I could just do beef. Who's what for dinner? Guy's awesome. So I'm reading the story as we're looking for news. And actually, you know, Matt brought the story. That, you know, Pink, the singer, who is, by the way, an amazing story in her own right. She battled drug addiction early in her life before she became successful. She was a person that really could have gone the wrong direction in life. But as many people have told you recently, hold on tight to your dreams. Don't give up. Dream big, right? And she did, and she's incredibly talented, incredible performer. She was being interviewed by a radio show, and she mentioned that her 11-year-old daughter doesn't have a cell phone, and her 11-year-old daughter is the only one in her class who doesn't have a cell phone. At 11, I'm thinking, okay, that's crazy. Or a social media account, which is more specifically the gist of the interview and what I took from it and what I'd like to talk about. Pink says that her daughter can only get a cell phone and have a social media account. And again, she's the only 11-year-old in her class at school that doesn't have a cell phone already. She says, you can have a cell phone when you bring me literature that says social media is good for kids. And that's, first off, never going to happen. So good on you, Pink. Way to find the bulletproof qualification for your kid getting a social media account and a phone at 11.
I loved what she did go on to say, though. She's like, my kid is so smart. If it's out there, they will find it.
Yeah, boy, ain't that the truth. And thinking that we can be the tech watchdogs, the tech gatekeepers for our kids is so naive, is so delusional. Kids always find a way to get where they need to go in life. But I want to talk about kids and cell phones and social media in particular, about how helpful it can be, but more importantly, how dangerous it can be. I've mentioned to you before that I got two kids. My older child, my older daughter, was pre-social media. Now, they did have a cell phone, but later. It wasn't like she was, you know, crying for one at 11 or 13.
What was the first phone? Was it like one of those flip phones?
Yeah. The little flips. Yep. And I remember getting so mad at her once because she was doing something, and I took her phone, I snapped it in half, literally, and said, okay, you've lost your privileges. I forget, we had set boundaries, and she had ignored them and broken rules. So I snapped her phone in half. What I should have done was got her one of those bricks, like in the old 80s ski movies, you know, those the phone that weighs like 19 pounds.
Great thing about that is not only can you take calls while mobile, you can also get in a workout.
Yes, you can. And it works as a self. What was that one? It's also a self-defense mechanism. You bonk somebody in the head with it.
And a doorstop.
Anti-theft. It comes with anti-theft. Bam! My younger child is a child of the social media age, and we had to weigh when to get them their first cell phone and when to allow them on social media. And it's a tricky needle to thread because, first off, there's peer pressure and the curiosity of every other kid is got one, you know, and your kid feels like just a lump on a log for being the kid in class whose parents haven't given them access to the world outside their immediate social circle yet. But that's what's dangerous about it is it doesn't just give them access to the world outside their physical, immediate social circle. It gives that world that world access to them. And it's a two-way street. And that's what's dangerous about it. And when you're a parent, you worry about who your kid interacts with and what they see. And we can talk about the different peer pressures that social media brings to a kid. It's wonderful to be able to share with friends and to be up on the latest trends, and whether it's TikTok trends or the latest filter that makes you look like a bunny or a puppy that all your friends are playing with. And it's important that kids feel included in the social norms of their set at the appropriate age. By the way, most psychology professionals and child development professionals will recommend that middle school is the appropriate time for a kid to have not just a cell phone, but more importantly, access to social media. There are times when kids need cell phones for safety reasons. Kids who are maybe latchkey kids or, you know, kids who spend time independently. Latchkey kids, that's such a dated term, right? When kids would come home from school and parents both would be working and kids would come home to an empty house. That's the term latchkey kids. I imagine that's still very prevalent in society where kids are left on their own for a period of their time. And at that point, a cell phone is a safety feature, right? And there are ways to make the access kids have to social media and to a cell phone in general. There are ways to make that access safer. You know, I know a lot of apps like TikTok, for example, has restrictive governances you can put on the phone as a parent, where you can not just limit, you know, who a kid can call or how long a kid can be on TikTok. I know TikTok recently, in order to stop ruining an entire generation of young Americans, they put this thing out that after an hour, a TikTok account for anyone under 16, I believe it is, has to sign back into their account after an hour so they don't mindlessly scroll for hours and hours on end. I don't think that's a legitimate and valid deterrent for having kids have to reboot their TikTok so they can keep surfing down the rabbit hole. I think, you know, at some point under the age, maybe 16, an hour's it from TikTok. But that's what I'm talking about with parental controls. You can set that as a parent. When you give your kid access to social media, whether it's Instagram, whether it's TikTok, whether it's, I don't know if kids do Facebook. I think that's just a dinosaur's medium like myself. But various, you know, what are kids on if it's not TikTok and Instagram? Snapchat, is that still a thing? Is that been and gone? I don't know, Matt. You know a little better.
You talked to me like I'd have any proximity to anything youthful.
Well, but true. You're a whole generation younger than me. And you still are a generation beyond.
I'm a 40-year-old, 80-year-old.
Well, I'm a 60-year-old, 40-year-old. What an interesting world we're developing here. The point is that parents can really become involved and should become involved in what their kids have access to in the way of social media. I mean, first and foremost, the first time you give your kid a cell phone or a social media access to a social media account, part of being able to enter that arena of social media where that all your friends are at is that your parents have complete access, all your passwords. And a lot of people have a problem with invading their kids' privacy. But trust me when I tell you it's a small, small price to pay for knowing your kid is safe. Because you don't trust a 15-year-old, a 13-year-old. With knowing what's safe and what's not safe. They're innocent. They're curious by nature. They're trusting by nature until we, you know, smash it out of them. As a parent, you have to get in there once in a while and make sure to check to see what they're looking at is what they say they're looking at. And what they're looking at is age appropriate. I know that most psychologists will tell you that kids develop emotionally maturity at different ages, at different levels. You got to know your kid. You got to know if your kid's a tough kid, a streetwise kid, a sensitive kid. Our youngest was young beyond her years for a long time. We took great comfort in that. That my youngest went to a private school for K-8. You know, we had the luxury and ability to provide a private school education from my younger child, which we're talking like 14 kids to a classroom, a full time teacher, full time assistant to that class. Small class sizes, small private school. That being said, we knew most of the people that she was interacting with. We knew those families. You know, we could make sure that we had access to things. And we knew her maturity level. We knew that she was kind of young for her age. So we knew that when she got access to social media, it was important that we knew all her passwords and that she knew that we'd be checking up on things. And of course we trust you. Of course we take your word for it. But we're going to, you know, like President Bush said, trust but verify. You know, and it's like that camera in the corner of the store that doesn't even need to be working. When you see the camera there, you're going to be more resonant to steal. You know, you're going to be hesitant to steal something, right? Because you think you're being watched. When you think you're being watched, you play it a little safer. You play it a little straighter down the middle of the field. And when a kid knows that everything they type in their phone can be recorded and checked, everybody they reach out to, everybody that connects with them, we're going to know. And we're going to make sure that you're doing what you say and you're not going to be doing something that you're not supposed to be doing. My sister's child down in Florida, I think I've mentioned this before, but it bears repeating with relevance to this topic. My sister's child fell in with a group of people that she had never met except through social media. And these kids were out of state. And these kids came from, you know, I don't want to say broken homes, but, you know, homes where they spent a lot of time alone, weren't supervised, were left to scour the internet and circle the globe on their own without supervision. And these kids tended to be meaner and a little bit on the bullying side and very dishonest with their parents. And my sister told her daughter, you know, look, we want to know everything you say. We're going to check all your passwords. And when she started, you know, socializing, interacting on a social media level with these kids, truly bad kids, kids that were talking about violence against other kids and were threatening violence against their parents because they weren't getting their way. That's dangerous. That's red flags time, right? My sister said, look, you're losing your access. You're losing your social media. You're losing your phone. You violated our trust and you broke the rules and there's consequences. And when you've earned your phone back, there's going to be complete transparency. We're going to know every site you visit, every key you type, every person you talk to. We're going to check on a daily basis until we feel we can trust you again. And they had to go through that, and it was painful, especially, I mean, kids' job is to rebel. That's what a kid's job is to do, is to test the limits. They're like the raptors in Jurassic Park. They keep testing the fences, right? That's what kids are supposed to do. I mean, that's what we did as kids, except when we did it as kids, the knucklehead stuff we got into was told mom and dad we're staying at a friend's house, but we're out drinking at night. You know, we're sleeping in a field next to an empty keg. Wake up covered in grass stains and dew, you know? Kids these days are at a lot more risk. The troubles my generation faced as kids, the troubles Matt's generation faced as kids, are nothing compared to the predatory nature of whack jobs out there trying to meet kids on the internet. There's a filter for internet connections, for social media connections. I swear I saw this on the news. It's a de-aging filter. It's a guy can put this filter on and look like themselves at 17.
That won't be abused on dating sites at all.
You think? I saw them like, why? Who makes this? What's the VBR, valid business reason for having this filter other than predatorcam.com? And you see these kind of things and you have to warn your kids. I'm a firm believer that education and communication is the most important part of being a parent. You know, it's not your job to be your parent's friend. You hear that all the time. I think it is your job to be your kid's friend, rather. But I think that's got to be balanced with them knowing who the hammer is in a relationship, in a household, whose job it is to keep them safe, whose job it is to maintain the guardrails of their growing experiences, how they enter the world, how the world gets into their room at night. You see apps that make an old man look like a teenager. And you warn kids, not everybody you're talking to is who they say they are. I mean, it's like, I got to tell my kid what the term catfishing means. I don't think so. My kid's a lot more savvy than I am. But, you know, having these kids realize how dangerous it is. But that being said, I think I've covered well enough the dangers. And we all know the dangers of a kid on social media, right? But it's also important to realize how beneficial social media relationships can be for kids. Especially during the pandemic when everybody was shut down, couldn't go visit your friends, couldn't even go to school. All the socialization kids were doing was on social media. You know, kids tend to feel isolated and alone and outcast far too often. When they can share a problem on the social media networks and find out that there are other people who feel the same way, that's really beneficial. I mean, it's not all dark, dangerous, sticky catch a predator moments on social media. There are really good things, good communities that can be built, good relationships can be built on social media. But it's imperative for a parent to make sure they know what's going on and know who their kids are talking to. You know, Pink's kids class, they're 11 and they've all got phones. I'm thinking, what rich neighborhood does she live in? What specialty school is her kid going? And that's no knock on that. Like I said, we sent our youngest to sent both our kids to private schools. Actually, my older one all the way through school. Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with being able to provide a private, you know, high end education for your kid. It's investing in your kid's future. It's nothing wrong with that. You know, just talking to your kid, and accountability and honesty. Warning your kid. It's your job to scare your kid. It's better that you scare your kid than you leave your kid unawares and naive to the real dangers that are out there on social media. I mean, I'm got more respect than ever for Pink. So, you know, you're not ready for social media. I don't care if every kid in your class has one. I care about you more than they care about you. You know, I care about your well-being and your future and your physical and mental health. You know, we didn't even get into the bullying aspect of social media, the peer pressure of social media. You know, it used to be the kid only had to be liked by the kids in their class. That was easy. Now you got to be liked by at least 10,000 people when you post something where you feel inferior. Your body image is compared to all these people with filters and you know, the most beautiful moments of their life. Not everybody's lying by the pool looking great in a bikini or having an incredible meal. Life's tough on everybody from time to time. As soon as kids are aware of that feeling, you know, off some days, feeling unpopular some days, that's just part of life. That's part of growing up. It's normal. So everybody's supposed to feel. If you don't feel the downtimes, you're not going to ever appreciate the times that feel good. If you think life's just one big, happy, good time, never-ending good time parade, you're asking for failure and you're asking for to be really let down hard. Anyway, I told you we're going to get serious. Let's talk about music or something next. Something lighthearted. What perverted, dirty music is your kid listening to? Let's talk about parental warning labels.
Probably some rapper on SoundCloud.
Let's get Tipper Gore on the phone and play some Judas Priest for you or some Ozzy. It's going to be great. It's Cairo Nights. I'm Spike O'Neill with Matt Butler. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Cairo Nights. Yeah. Boy, I teased about talking about explicit lyrics and the textures went bananas. Remember 2 Live Crew? Oh, yeah. I remember 2 Live Crew.
Although this song brings back some memories.
I know, right? Although 2 Live Crew have a special place in my heart because they kind of took parody to the Supreme Court with their parody of Roy Orbison's Pretty Woman. And they won that case, and that opened the door for Bob Rivers and Downtown Joe and I to make just tons of song parodies with impunity. We didn't care what anybody thought until Gene Simmons tried to sue us, and that was then we still didn't learn. We made songs after that anyway. Matt brought this story, and I love this story. We talked last week about how vinyl outsold CDs for the first time in, 30 years, right? And vinyl has had an uptick in sales annually every year for I think the last 17 years. Every year there's been more vinyl sold. I know it's a nostalgic thing for most folks, you know, and finding a good turntable is harder than finding good vinyl.
There are a lot of hipsters that just skip the turntable and just put up the vinyl. It's like display their records. They don't even play them.
You know, I can see that, the value in that. I can see why you would want to do that from a romantic and a nostalgic point of view. Because album art, to me, is some of the greatest art of all time. You know, I've got a friend who used to do radio in Seattle, Jeff Aaron, the Fish. Used to be on the sports talk station. Jeff went up and did radio up in Everett for a while at that station. Then he, you know, as all smart people do, eventually moved to the Sun down in the Southwest.
And well, I thought you were going to say, as all smart people do, they eventually get out of radio.
Well, there's that. No, he's doing radio down there, and he's doing other, you know, other stuff. But online all the time, he will have battles of album art. He'll have like the album art Olympics, where he'll pit two great album covers against each other, like a tournament, and then finally, you know, moving on to the finals. Album art is some of the greatest art of all time, because it's tied not just to the artwork on the album cover, like Molly Hatchett's, you know, Barbarian, right? Or whatever it might be, Led Zeppelin IV with the old man and the bundle of sticks on his back, right? Tommy's cover, the Who Tommy cover is a beautiful piece of art. And those aren't even the good ones. I mean, some album art is worthy of framing. So I get that hipsters buy vinyl. Maybe that's probably a huge portion of why vinyl's so hot again. It's not even for playing. But I truly believe that sound sounds better. Music sounds better on vinyl. There's a warmth to vinyl you don't get from CDs, let alone files. Downloading digital files, I don't believe that any music will ever sound great if the only version you have is a downloaded file. You have to be listening to it. Like, I mean, you can't hear Dark Side of the Moon through your phone and some earbuds. You got to have vinyl and a good Technics turntable with a nice diamond stylus and a big pair of headphones. And sit down and maybe, I don't know, cure cataracts for a few minutes and then enjoy Pink Floyd as it was meant to be enjoyed, being shoved into both ears and in stereo. Vinyl rocks. The problem is vinyl is such a hot commodity and such a nostalgic trend on the rise, much like bell bottoms and all things that come back, because everything was better in the 70s. It's not just you. It was better. There's a shortage of vinyl production. There's a bottleneck and the ability to make enough vinyl for the increasing demand. So Metallica bought themselves a vinyl factory. The guys at Metallica bought the vinyl company, the record-making vinyl company that's been making their vinyl since 1987. Guys from Metallica got together and bought this little vinyl factory. Excuse me, Furnace Record Pressing, right? A Virginia pressing plant that's been making their discs for the last 15 years. They invested in art. I think that's fantastic. I've got some vinyl at home, some old vinyl at home. You know, so my daughter, my younger, wanted to get a turntable. You know why? You know where she saw it, Matt? At Urban Outfitters, right? I mean, here's a store that's full of, you know, vintage, knockoff vintage t-shirts and distressed clothing, you know, clothing that looks like you bought it at a yard sale or a thrift store.
Can I diverge something here that it just occurs to me this mildly annoys me?
Sure.
Concert t-shirts for people who were too young to have been at the show. I think that's a little bit of cheating. I buy my concert tees when I go to the show, not 40 years after the fact from a show I didn't see.
I can see where, as a purist, I mean, I used to wear concert shirts like as a badge of honor. You know, I was at the Grateful Dead in 1980, the summer tour. You
exactly,
know,
the milestones.
Yes, exactly. I saw, you know, U2's Under a Blood Red Sky tour. Right, I don't fit in that shirt anymore. My younger wears my Elvis Costello tour shirts from 1981 because they don't fit me, and I love to see them in that shirt.
But don't you feel sometimes like it's just this thing if they manufacture like remakes of the shirt to put in a store like Urban Outfitters?
No,
No, you're like 10 years old. You did not see Nirvana before they became famous. it's a minor thing. But
you
just
weren't at the Mad Season New Year's Eve show in 1993. No, you weren't.
Yeah.
No, I hear you. And I have no problem with old school looking rock band shirts. The Sticky Fingers Tongue, the Pink Floyd Prism, whatever, my AC/DC, you know. I got no problem with shirts of bands from that era being made and sold at JCPenney or Sears or wherever. Urban Outfitters, I'm going to pick on them specifically. You're right, though. I mean, it's cool to see vintage shirt remakes, but vintage tour remakes, I'm with you. You weren't at Live Aid, you little liar. Your parents weren't at Live Aid. Your parents are too young to be in Philadelphia in 1975. They weren't, or 1985. They weren't there. I was there. You weren't there. I saw Amnesty International with Sting, Bruce, Peter Gabriel, Yoso Endor, and Tracy Chapman. I was there in Philadelphia at the stadium. I posted that picture on social media about a month ago. Somebody put a shot out of the Rolling Stones Some Girls tour from JFK Stadium in Philadelphia. Probably 110,000 people packed into the stadium. They had an aerial shot of this. And I saved it. I'm having it blown up and framed because I was in that crowd. You know, I brought a T-shirt home from the Stones 78 Philadelphia Some Girls tour, and I wore that thing till it fell off. I was so proud of being at that show, and that live T-shirt was such a badge of honor. You know, when The Who played right after Cincinnati, right after Keith Moon had died, right? I went to that tour, and I wore that shirt. It had like a Keith Moon memorial on the back, you know, 1943 to 1978, Keith Moon, you know. I wore that shirt till it was so threadbare it fell apart. And some kid who's 16 this year wearing that same shirt, I've seen that same shirt reproduced. There's a website that makes like every Stones tour shirt from 75, from 78, 81, 84. You weren't at that show, you little mongoose. I'm with you. I appreciate it because I hadn't realized how much it bugged me, but it does. Getting back to vinyl. I love the memory of cleaning a record, you know, blowing on it, getting the record cleaner and coming to crown and putting it on the platter and dropping that. The skill to drop a needle between two songs because, you know, order, there's an art to it, right? But if you want to hear that one song and be able to drop a needle in between two tracks, that's skill, man. The kids today will never know that
that's
skill.
That's one of the things that frustrates me a little bit about this digital stat where they say the average listener only listens to, say, 7 to 10 seconds of a song before deciding whether they're going to keep listening or fast forward to Spotify. And that's what bugs me because I'm not saying you have to listen to stuff you don't like, but the shuffle has obliterated the value and investment in an album as a complete body of work. For most listeners, they don't wrap their heads around it.
Do today's artists even think about that?
Probably
thinking about,
not.
You know, I mean, seriously, you're probably right. They don't. It used to be, and maybe I'm just get off my lawn guy right now, but it used to be that an artist, I mean, like Springsteen's my prime example for everything always. Bruce had put together like 40 songs for Born in the USA, for example. Right, and you had to pick which songs made it and which songs didn't. And then you had to decide what order the songs go into. It was always my belief that the best songs on an album, in order, were 2, 3, 1. The second best song on the album was the first thing.
Lost or that there's no good music being made. But I am saying is when everything is too easily available to the consumer, their appreciation for things sometimes can be lost, and I think that's sad.
And to play the other devil's advocate here, play the other side of the coin, there are artists who will never release an album. I mean, they just drop singles, and that's cool. You know, I mean, there are artists. I mean, for example, the new Miley Cyrus, the Flowers song, right? I don't want to hear the rest of a Miley Cyrus album. I really don't. But that's a great tune, and she put it out. And it's a great, you know, she put it out one single, boom, boom, boom. Artists these days will never know how to construct the sequence of an album, how important the track sequence of an album can be to telling a story.
But for some artists, too, you look at them as singles artists and they are capable of an album. Case in point, Taylor Swift, great pop singles, Folklore, Different Thing, awesome album.
Yeah, yeah, hear, hear. Yeah, I love talking music. And kudos to you, Metallica, for buying the Furnace Record Pressing Vinyl Factory to make sure that not just your albums, but other vinyl is going to get made and there's going to be a supply chain that's going to deliver to people. And you kids who buy albums just to hang them on your wall, buy a turntable, buy a decent one, invest in a good set of speakers and a turntable with a real diamond stylus and listen to music as it was intended. Even if it's just your dad's music, as I did. I promise you, son... What's that line from Scent of Woman? I promise. Oh, when he's talking about Charlie, it's worth it. He's an investment. He's worth it. I promise you. Anyway, it's Cairo Nights. We'll be right back. saw this tour and have the t-shirt.
Yeah.
Welcome back to Cairo Nights. I saw Stevie Wonder play live in Square Circle was the album. And it was a polo shirt with an embroidered logo. And that's how cool the Stevie Wonder tour was. And I'm proud to have that shirt. We found a bunch of old shirts. My wife and I did as we're going through that storage unit I was telling you about. We went through these. I brought these shirts from the East Coast when I was still skinny in the late 80s. And then we moved them all to storage when we sold our first home and bought our second home. And they've been sitting in a storage box for over 15 years and we dug them out recently. It was a trip down memory lane. It really was. We're going to play an hour of the midday show coming up at 9 o'clock as we've been tending to do for the last few weeks as we're finding out what to do here at Cairo, what the future looks like. And I appreciate you guys being welcoming and open-minded about the midday show. I appreciate, Matt, you helping me put all that together and making sure this happens on a nightly basis.
And I would also like to throw in for people who would like to hear you and Jack Stein on the midday show, they can find that podcast on mynorthwest.com/podcast, Cairo Middays. Check it out.
And that's why he's in the producer's chair, ladies and gentlemen. I would like to point out, though, I mentioned during my reference to Pauly Shore, talking about movies tonight with Frank Sumrall, I said, hey, look, I like some Pauly Shore movies. I liked Son-in-Law. I like Biodome with that missing Baldwin. Was that Steven, I believe, in that one? Who's the blonde Baldwin? I don't even know. Anyway, I said, everybody makes a bad movie. And a texter chimed in, everybody makes a bad movie? Name a bad Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. Fair enough. You're right. I'm not going to go back to the bodybuilder movies because there were a few out there that, you know, he was learning how to do it and he was being paid for this physical specimen that he was, not for his acting chops. But once Arnold figured it out, Arnold really hasn't made a bad movie. I don't care if it's Jingle All the Way, Twins, Junior, where he was a pregnant guy. Even that had some moments. Arnold can do it. And whether it's Terminator, Predator, Commando, when Arnold's being Arnold, is nobody better. You know, it's nobody better. Fair enough. I stand corrected. Not everybody makes a bad movie. Everybody but Arnold makes a bad movie. How about that? We'll say that. Even the great Bruce Willis made Hudson Hawk. So, yes, everybody can make a bad movie. Our thoughts and prayers for Bruce Willis, by the way. Boy, what a horrible, tragic story that is. He's still around, but we talked about his medical diagnosis, and I hope his family's giving him all the love and attention and support he deserves. Talk about tour shirts. People like 96 Horde Tour, Horde Festival at the Gorge, Lenny Kravitz walking through the crowd playing. I'm with you, Jeff. Moments like that, man. I thought we were going lighter in this segment. You sound more upset.
That one was probably for me.
No. It's when I started rambling about kids. You and I both jumped down that canyon together about kids wearing tour shirts.
Hey, you, get off of my lawn.
I know, right? Yeah. Thank you, folks. I appreciate that. Baseball shirts were the best concert shirts ever. Those three-quarter sleeve, you know, white shirts with the colored sleeves. Those are the greatest. When my daughter was working in Manhattan in New York, she worked at a vintage clothing store, and I've told you this story before, too. People in New York were, what's that line from Stripes? Chicks in New York are paying top dollar for this. They sold a Led Zeppelin USA 76 authentic tour shirt for $1,500 at this yuppie Manhattan vintage clothing store. Yes, I shipped more concert t-shirts to my daughter in New York and she sold them in that vintage clothing shop on consignment. It was it helped her get through a couple years living in Brooklyn.
Or at least a couple months.
Yeah. People are saying they're right. There's nothing like vinyl. Vinyl has warmth. Where's the quote you had? Matt, you had the best quote of the night.
Someone asked the famed British DJ John Peel if he preferred CDs to vinyl, because vinyl has surface noise. John Peel looked at him in his great British accent, which I am not going to attempt to reproduce, said, listen, mate, life has surface noise.
And that's why vinyl will always be better. Thank you, folks. Thank you, Matt. Great job. It's Cairo Nights. We'll be back tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. Please enjoy a little retread from today's midday show. Hope you have a good evening.